It sometimes happens to those of us who are preachers that we hear or see an interpretation of a text that stays with us for a long time and defines that text more than anything else we have read subsequently. That is true of this text that Barbara just read, and I owe a deep debt to our mutual friend, the late Casey Tomey, whose paper and then later sermon on this text has shaped my thinking about the way it comes together. And I owe a considerable debt to him that I borrow from some of his work in this sermon. One of the intriguing places of my childhood along the Florida Gulf Coast was Tarpon Springs. That little coastal village held a mysterious and magical fascination for me. Before Cuban refugees began flooding our area when Fidel Castro came to power, the largely Greek citizens of Tarpon Springs provided my only contact with an immigrant population. Tarpon Springs was located along the Gulf of Mexico's liveliest sponge beds. And so perhaps once a year we would drive the 15 miles to Tarpon Springs to ride a sponge boat and watch the divers bring up the sponges and then have lunch in one of the Greek restaurants there. We would make that drive again every year, every winter, on the 6th day of January for the annual diving for the cross on the day of Epiphany. A Greek Orthodox bishop, impressively dressed and standing in a boat, would toss a silver cross into the water of Spring Bayou, and hundreds of boys and young men would have braved the cold waters to dive for the cross. This was years before the women joined in the diving as well. The one who brought up the cross was supposedly guaranteed a year of good fortune. Now, to this day, mention Epiphany to me, and those are the images that come to mind. My home church didn't celebrate Epiphany. For that matter, we didn't celebrate Advent or Lent or Pentecost either. I grew up in a plain vanilla pre-ecumenical Presbyterian church. It was pretty much the preliminaries, the preaching, and the benediction. So it was many years later that I finally learned of the significance of this celebration, that it is an unveiling, that it is a surprising revelation. Last year, I saw the cartoon for the first time that depicted a French cafe slightly resembling Claudette's down the avenue with tables on the sidewalk outside, and the diners are speaking in exclamation marks. They are saying, one says, these eggs are astounding, and a second says, it's a caffeine miracle, and a third virtually shouts, now I understand hash browns. And the caption says, breakfast at Epiphany's. For the purpose of the Christian faith, though, Epiphany is the 12th day of Christmas, when we celebrate the visit of the Magi to the Christ child, the day we celebrate the revelation of Christ to the non-Jewish world of the Gentiles, as represented by those wise men from the East. Mysterious figures, they. What we don't know about the wise men far exceeds what we do know. For example, how many there were. If we say three, we are certainly in line with the tradition. But the truth is, the Bible doesn't say. It does say that three gifts were brought to the Christ child, and I suppose folks simply surmised that there were three gift bearers. But in the Christian tradition, there have been as few as two mentioned and as many as 12. The Far Side's Gary Larson once argued that, unbeknownst to most theologians, there was a fourth wise man who was turned away for bringing a fruitcake. Matthew doesn't give a number, though. He simply says, wise men from the East. We also don't know how they traveled to get where they found the Christ child. If you're thinking camels, then you're probably looking at our stack of Christmas cards at home. But Matthew never mentions camels or any other animals. Camels are mentioned in the Isaiah passage today, but not in Matthew. The fact of the matter is, they might have walked. One early Christian artist depicted them riding on horses, but to my knowledge, Hallmark has never put that work on any of the Christmas cards that I've seen. And the names. Well, we know some names. They are, of course, Gaspar and Melchior and Balthazar, but those names weren't offered up until the 8th century. Matthew, the only gospel to name these, to mention the wise men, never offers their names. So the truth is, we don't know much about these visitors at all. But they are such mysterious characters that it's little wonder why so many stories and legends have grown up around them. Of course, most of those stories have no roots in the biblical story and thus tend to obscure the meaning that Matthew may be trying to communicate in this account. What we do know is that the Magi came from the east and that they were thus Gentiles, not Jews. We know that they had a star to guide them, but not so precisely that they didn't have to stop and ask for directions from Herod and his constituents. And we know that Herod and his constituents also had in common with the Magi one thing, that they were all recipients of that epiphany that we celebrate on this day, this last day of Christmas. Epiphany, the revelation of God in the Christ child to the Magi and thus to the Gentiles. That is to say, to people like you and me. Herod and his entourage are not Gentiles. They are Jews. And yet they receive a revelation of the birth of the child too. Yet oddly, they receive it from the Magi that when they pay a visit to seek the king of the Jews and stop by to see the current king to find directions on how to find the new king that's been born. Only then do Herod and his scholars discover that they have had all that news all along in their scriptures. See, these are people who gathered every Sabbath around the book, the law, the prophets, the wisdom, and yet they do not know, they do not understand exactly. Herod, representing the entire religious establishment, is surprised when the wise man comes seeking the Christ child. Magi, on the other hand, don't have the scriptures. They do not have access to the traditions of Judaism and its ancient wisdom. Their epiphany comes in nature in the form of a leading star. Also, since they're not Jews, they would seem the least likely persons, perhaps, to receive such a revelation, because the popular wisdom was that only the chosen people, God's elect, could receive such news, such a revelation themselves. And yet here are outsiders, Gentiles, who see a star and rightly interpret its meaning and go in search of the one whose birth it announces. All through the Old Testament, there are times when God chooses outsiders as instruments of the divine will. But still, in the coming of the Magi, we find another surprise. And herein, as Casey Tomey noted, is the truly clever part of Matthew's story, of his telling of this story. Because neither of these groups, neither Herod nor the Magi, have everything they need to find this child. The people with the scriptures need the outsiders to help them understand. The outsiders with the natural revelation in the stars need the scriptures to help them understand what's being revealed. Matthew's stunning point seems to be that God's truth is revealed to both Jew and Gentile alike, but to each only partially. Religious insiders and religious outsiders need each other in order to understand fully the manifestation of God's truth. Another way to say it is this, that God has a way of working outside the religious establishment as well as within it. Religious folks don't have the corner on God's truth. Matthew is not content to make this point only here in chapter 2. He keeps coming back to it again and again throughout his gospel. For example, he tells of a Canaanite woman, a Gentile foreigner, who comes to Jesus seeking help for her child. And Jesus will say to her rather curtly, "I came for the lost sheep of the house of Israel, not for foreign dogs like you." But she catches him with her reply, "Yes, but Lord, even the dogs are allowed the crumbs that fall from the master's table." And Jesus responds to her, "Woman, great is your faith." At another point, Matthew tells of a centurion who approaches Jesus because he has a servant who has been paralyzed. The man does not dare to invite Jesus to his home because he knows that Jews are not allowed to be in that close contact with Gentiles. So he says to Jesus, "Only say the word, and my servant will be healed." And Jesus says to him, to this Gentile centurion, "Truly I tell you, in no one in Israel have I found such faith." And then too, the centurion on watch after Jesus' crucifixion, seeing what happens at Golgotha, he proclaims, "Truly this man was the Son of God." Matthew simply cannot let go of this important point. He wants us so to understand God's revelation is not limited to any one nation or any one religion or any one people. When God's Messiah, God's Son, comes into the world, his revelation of truth and love and goodness is not constrained by narrow human boundaries. It is available to all people. To all people. The sign of the star is a sign for all. The story of the Magi has an edge to it. I believe it speaks to what has been going on in recent years in our increasingly globalized world, and particularly in our own culture. Our nation has become increasingly religiously pluralistic, and it surely won't be long, if we aren't there already, when Christianity ceases to be the dominant faith in America, even if it claims that name. At the same time, our culture has become increasingly secularized and divided, so raising voices of faith and conscience seems at times to be about as effective as whistling into the wind, especially given the way such conscience has been distorted or abandoned by those who speak the loudest. Now, some folks have felt the need to circle the theological wagons to protect themselves against what appears to be, at least to them, the enemy. There have been voices in most every branch of the church calling us to do so, to perpetuate an us-them frame of mind and to wage battle, as it were. It's as though folks think that God cannot reveal God's grace and goodness and truth to anyone but them, or that God cannot be at work in the so-called secular world or in the world of those others that some deem as heretics. Matthew's wonderful story of the Magi should give us reason to pause and to think critically on such an attitude. Now, let me be clear. Do I believe that Jesus is the light of the world? Yes, I do. Do I believe that Christ is the eternal Word made flesh? Yes, again, I do. Do I believe that he is the way, the truth, and the life? Yes, I do. And I believe that if the world would only live after the manner of Christ's compassion and peace and grace, we would not be in the mess we find ourselves in these dark days. But I also believe that God is larger than I can conceive God to be. I know from our own history that God chooses people outside our circle to judge us, to teach us, to humble us at times, and remind us of who we're meant to be. I think it happens globally to nations and leaders that assume too much and claim too much and act too much as though they're the only ones who count. I know it happens to religious people who do the same. Arrogance in such matters is a sad and dangerous thing, as God's own chosen people learned once at Bethlehem, when it took some outsiders to help them see the light, light that shone like a bright beaming star above a rude stable, a guiding star that still shines. If only we have eyes to see.